and welcome to Two Fat Expats. And when we say fat, we're not talking bathroom scales or excess luggage. Two Fat Expats are all about making the most of your expat adventure and filling it up with as much as you can so that when it's all over, there's no regrets. You've lived a fat expat life. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie expat who's based in Doha, Qatar. And I'm joined by Nikki Moffat.
Hello.
Another Aussie, but Nikki's in Hamburg, Germany. We've lived in 12 countries between us. We consider ourselves experts in all matters of the geographically challenged. Between us, we've given birth in 6 countries, and we know what it's like to pack up yet another kitchen, start looking for another job, and wave goodbye to that brilliant hairdresser it took you 12 months to find. We've both made those first steps into the brand new office, or worse, the new school, and at times we've found ourselves jobless, friendless, and starting afresh all over again. Each week we talk to expats who are from all over the world, and we discuss our favourite finds, our biggest stuff-ups, and we get the best tips for packing it all in. Okay, are we ready to go? Let's do this. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Kirsty Rice. How are you? I'm just mentally preparing myself for Ariana Grande concert tonight with a couple of 13-year-old girls. Apparently you have to be there when the doors open, which I don't think I've ever been to a concert that early. Can't wait.
I'm envisaging you at the doors, you know, right up the front and being pushed in by hundreds of 13-year-old girls. Racing towards Ariana.
I'm imagining much the same thing, and I'm a little bit horrified by the whole thing.
Do you know, Nikki, the last concert I went to with my kids was the Wiggles, so you are a much better parent than I am. But it was all very exciting anyway, and it has stayed in our memories because Murray came along, and we wanted an Australian flag to let the Wiggles know that, you know, even though we were in Canada, we were dinky, die true blues. But we didn't. The only flag we had, it was a tea towel that we used. So we took the tea towel off the oven door, and in we went to the concert. And when Murray came past and we waved our tea towel madly, and he gave us the big, you know, Wiggles thumbs up. It was very, very exciting. But I mean, we've moved on now. I'm now dropping children off at Five Sauce concerts and YouTubers who do live concerts, which still blows me away that YouTubers have that. And I, of course, pick up my children from music festivals, which is a whole different bag.
Kirsty, today we're talking about something that we don't have any experience of. You and I have nearly 40 years of expat life between us, and we're going to talk about something on the podcast today that we personally don't have experience of.
It took 6 seasons and 100 and something episodes, but yes, you and I are completely inadequate in this field. I feel like such a fraud because, unlike you, Nikki Moffat, child bride, I was single in the city until I was 29. So I, for the longest time, for my probably my first 10 expat years, I saw myself as a seasoned single when really I was masquerading as a mother of 4 children under the age of 6. And the reason for that is I was single until I had this whirlwind romance with my husband, you would hope so, where we met, were engaged in 3 weeks, married in 12, and off we set. So it was all very new. Married life was very new for me as an expat. But honestly, I look at expat singles in awe and wonder because I know with G and I, that's been half the fun for me is having him along for the ride. And I know how much we've had to kind of lean on each other through the process and how we've relied on each other. You know, there's been many times where one of us has felt like packing it in and the other one has said, no, keep going, this is good, or, you know, vice versa. But I'm really pleased that we're doing this episode because we've met some fantastic people, and B, I reckon we have scored some really good advice for expat singles out there, and I'm hoping this will also enlighten the non-singles out there for maybe paying special attention to the singles around them.
Yeah, I 100% agree. We had some amazing people respond to the post in the Facebook group, and we'll talk about that a bit later. But for now, are we going to get to our interviews? So I spoke to Lindsay, and Lindsay's from a Western European country, and she studied human rights and started her expat life by going abroad for her initial postgrad studies. Then she did a series of jobs in the nonprofit sector and lived in various Western European countries. She went to Timor-Leste as part of a peacekeeping force. And now she's living in an Eastern European country where she's doing her PhD, and she's with an intelligence unit to do that. So you can imagine, Kirsty, how long it took me to get to the questions about her being a single expat, because I was so, oh, tell me more about that. Tell me more about that. But finally, I did get to it. So here it is.
And yeah, decided on my moves by myself. I mean, that's, I guess, you know, one of the pros. I was kind of going over, okay, you know, what I've been doing and how has it impacted me. And one of the good things is you can just kind of pack up and move when you don't, you know, you don't feel like it anymore. There's not this sort of thing trying to hold you back of, okay, but what if my partner doesn't get a job, or will he or she get a visa? Or even, and I imagine this to be an even larger problem that's not always recognized. If you're in a same-sex relationship, you know, there's just certain countries that are just out of the question.
Yeah.
So I have to say that.
As a single expat, what do you think your biggest challenges have been?
You know, there's no sort of division of labor. I mean, it's great that you can do everything by yourself. You know, you can take your own decisions. You don't have to worry about taking anybody else into the equation, but that also means that you have you to rely on, and that's it. I mean, you know, maybe you have parents or you know, a really good friend, but they could be a continent away. And when you're, you know, at the city council trying to register, or you're trying to get yourself a mobile phone plan, or you're trying to get your, you know, your internet connection going at your new house, or even looking for a new house, you know, you don't sort of have that sounding board where you go, oh, you know, what do you think about this place? Or it's really, everything comes down to you. And you know, you have to take responsibility for you. I think that's on the practical side. On the more, I guess, social or emotional side, you really have to put in the hours and the work and the effort to meet new people. And it's interesting, when I got here with a couple of colleagues, they're like, oh, you're so good at doing this. I was like, well, it's been, you know, sort of my ninth move in about, you know, a decade. So I'm used to it now, putting myself out there, even if it feels really uncomfortable, to just, because I know if I don't, I'm just going to sit at home and basically not have friends. So on that side, it's really a challenge as well. Well, and then there's, you know, trying to find a partner when you're living abroad and moving so often. That's a whole different story that I could tell you about.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to go back to that, but I just want to go quickly ask you about the putting yourself out there and having to do all the work on the social side of things. Do you have a formula for that works, or do you find it's different depending where you're living? Is there something that you always do, pursue an interest, or you just see what comes up?
I mean, for me, it's really find what you enjoy doing, because, you know, when you enjoy doing something, it feels a little bit less like you're putting in the work. So I, even when I was living in my home country, I used to go to pub quizzes. So I try to find one in wherever I am, you know, because oftentimes they're in English. That oftentimes means there's at least some part of an expat community. So in probably my second or third week here, I wrote to this quiz I found on Facebook. I'm like, hey, I'm here. I'm dragging one colleague along, but literally we have no team. You know, can you tell me, can I just show up? Can we just, what's the deal? And these people just, you know, embraced me. They're like, come, we'll find you a team. And I met so many great friends there, both local and international, that it's really worked out really great. But, you know, at the same time, I'm also trying to branch out. So there was a group that was set up by some English speakers that do wine tasting. So that's something I've been trying to get more involved with. But, you know, if kind of depending on where you are, I think you really need to find something that you kind of enjoy doing anyway, because otherwise it becomes this emotional labor of, oh, this is another thing in my agenda I have to do, or another thing on my to-do list. And that's, you know, you already have so much going on. That's not really how you want to approach it, I feel.
We talk about, joke about, you know, meeting someone and immediately asking them to be your emergency contact. But how do you do that? For those of us that have a partner, we can at least say, okay, well, we've got each other as emergency contacts. And then sort of you have to find someone else if you happen to go away and leave small dependent people behind. But I mean, how do you find someone to be your emergency contact, or you don't?
That's a really good question, because I probably didn't. I probably just put down my parents in my home country, to be honest, because I didn't really think about that. Because it's also one of the things you're asked to do in sort of week one, right? Whenever you start a new
Or always.
And so I kind of initially start off usually with like my parents and my brother, and kind of go, all right, you know, if stuff is really bad, like doesn't matter what hour of the day or night it is, like you're going to have to call them and they will figure something out. And so I guess, if you sort of, you know, if you're in a program such as I am, where at least there's multiple people that start at the same time, you're all sort of in the same boat. I mean, I didn't really do it with emergency contacts, but I did do it pretty quickly with my spare key to my apartment. I was like, can I give you my spare key? I know I've only known you for like 4 weeks, but, you know, and she's just like, oh yeah, actually, that's a great idea. If you can keep mine. I was like, yeah, you know, let's help each other out. And I have in the past also put down a landlord where I was like, well, if I don't pay rent, you're going to get angry. So if something happens to me, you're not going to get your rent, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But what are the biggest surprises you think that you found of doing this by yourself?
To be honest, I guess it's on the dating side of things. I didn't think it was this difficult. I mean, I think dating is difficult anyway. I mean, finding somebody who, you know, who is your level of crazy and accepts your level of crazy and you accept their level of crazy is hard enough. But I think it sort of takes, you know, about a year and a half to 2 years to really find yourself comfortable in the place you're living, and to really know your way around and to sort of, you know, live your life like you're not constantly put out fires, but just get sort of into a routine of things. And that's usually the point where I move to a different country again, because my contract is up or I have a new job or, so you're this person that's constantly in flux. And then I've been really, really surprised by some of the responses when I went on a date of people that were just like, I can't date an expat. And I was like, okay, well, that's interesting. I remember very well, I was on a date with one guy, and I was talking about, you know, my work, and it's like, okay, well, you know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I was like, okay, this is starting to sound like a job interview, but okay, you know, so I'm happily talking, chatting, and he just stops dead in his tracks and goes like, okay, well, if you want another date, you have to promise me you're not going to move for the next 3 years. And I'm like, what? This is the first date. Who are you to throw ultimatums out there? You know? So, yeah, that did not lead to a second date.
Okay. I'm not going to date an expat. So do you look for other expats? Like, are there people that you find are more successful dating wise than others? Like, I guess in any situation, it's people who understand the situation that you're in.
Yeah, I think that makes the biggest difference. It's not necessarily whether they're an expat at that point in time. Like, I could definitely date somebody who's, you know, a native in the country I'm at, but if they've gone through the trials and tribulations of having moved to a different country once, at least once, right?
Yep.
Can kind of better understand where you're coming from and why, you know, why on days there's just this sort of thing of I just can't with this country, you know, without taking it so personal. So I do feel it's either expats or repats, if you will, that are a bit more compatible with me. And I know there's people that, you know, that just meet the love of their life and settle down in a country and that's it. But for me, it definitely needs to be some sort of recognition of, okay, we've both been through this before. We understand each other.
Yeah. Another one was saying that when she moves somewhere, her company's quite expat focused. So when she moves somewhere, there are often things that are available to families or couples, and there are particular rules around single men, but there's no rules around her as a single woman doing this.
I was reading that. That was really interesting. And I mean, I've noticed it in terms of sort of healthcare related things. You know, certain policies would cover Viagra, but not the pill. I was like, okay, Viagra means nothing to me. So why is this in your company policy? And yeah, I did experience once. I'm not even sure if that's truly expat related, although my boss was also, everybody there was working as an expat, but I got into a salary discussion where I found out I was being significantly underpaid, and I was told, yes, but you don't have a family to support. And I was just like, wow, that's, and then to add to the discriminatory nature of that comment anyway, one of my male colleagues who supposedly had to support a family was married but without any children, and his wife had a better job than he did. So I'm thinking, I'm pulling all this way by myself. You know, if that's the reasoning you're going with, you should pay me more.
And the male colleague was being paid more than you?
Yeah, both of them.
But so their argument was basically nonsensical.
Yeah, the really, I mean, once I brought it up, literally what she said was, you don't have a family to support. Of course, I brought it to HR, and then there was this whole debate about, oh, my program had less money, blah, blah, blah. It was never about, you know, not supporting people who were single, but that's basically what it came down to.
And what's one thing you think people should know about single expats that they might not?
You know, I think every now and then we too need to hang out, just, you know, friends on a couch. If you're married and, you know, your single expat friend seems to have it all together, no, we too fall apart, and we don't really have anyone to talk to. So do invite us over for that glass of wine, or, you know, cook dinner, because, you know, at some point I get sick and tired of having to do that by myself too. So just because I hear this in a lot of times, like, oh, but, you know, you have your life so together, you're so on top of things. And I kind of go like, I don't really have a choice. You know, it's like, it's, oh, but you deal with all these trials and tribulations so well. It's like, well, what is my alternative? I have no one else to pass it off to. And I'm not saying that's what married couples do, but, you know, you can maybe sort of negotiate, this is what I really hate doing, can you do it? No, I'll do this other thing. You know, there's no negotiating with myself. Either I do it or I don't. And if I don't, the only person I have to blame for, and the only person who needs to deal with the consequences, is me. So, yeah, or maybe that's the other thing. Stop, you know, stop telling us how you admire us for handling everything so well, because I'm like, there's no other way I could do it.
Oh, she was really, really interesting. I loved what she said about no sounding board. You know, there's no one to defer to. And, you know, that effort to meet new people, that it just comes back to what I was saying about the day-to-day stuff is so much easier when it's shared. But so much with us, our partners meet people, or we meet people, and then you all go together and you do it. But I imagine it is so much more exhausting when you're constantly doing it on your own. I loved your question about the emergency contact. Do you know, I'm on my third emergency contact here in Doha because people keep bloody leaving. But only last night I had someone send me a text and say, hey, do you mind being my emergency contact? Because, yeah, that's half the thing, isn't it?
Doesn't it give you a warm and fuzzy feeling when someone asks you to be their emergency contact? I always think about the good things. Oh, that means they really like me and they trust me and they think I'm responsible. And I never think that I'm ever going to have to do anything like call someone with terrible news. I just think, yeah, I love this part of it.
And at the same point, isn't it soul destroying too, when you get the school forms at the beginning of the year and now it's all computerized, and you go into your account and you see your friend's name and their telephone number that you know no longer works, and they no longer live at that address, and that you can't have them as the emergency contact anymore, and you have to cross them out and find another one. Yeah. Nikki, I spoke to Kate, and I will give no further explanation because I think it's all in the interview, but I started off by asking her how she became an expat.
I'm 39, but I've worked for my company almost 10 years. And 5 years into working for them, they're multinational.
Yes.
They sent me to Singapore, and I did pretty well. So they sent me to Thailand, and now I work for Europe, actually. I don't really have a home. I live on airplanes for the last year. I split my time between Brussels and Atlanta, Georgia in the U.S.
Right. Okay. So where is originally home for you?
I was raised in Washington, D.C. in the U.S.
So walk me through it. Like, I mean, our question was, what is expat life like as a single? And I loved what you said, because you said it's definitely not easier, but perhaps it's not harder, just different.
Yeah.
And yes, because you are traveling and having to move about and do all of those things on your own. So do you think, I guess if you were to compare yourself to your partnered colleagues, do you feel you miss that sort of support system that they may have?
Yeah, I think some of it is, I mean, it's a mix. It's a mix for everybody, right? And I suppose I should say I love this life. It's definitely not all negative. But there's a lot of bias or habit in policies, in structure, in like clubs for partners,
yes,
expats who come as a family or partnered up. And so sometimes I find coming as a single can be very isolating because you're just unusual. And so it always takes everybody a little bit to sort of figure out what to do with you.
Yes.
And that puts a lot of burden on me as the individual, too, to kind of figure out how I'm going to make a life for myself that's comfortable and you know, doesn't feel too isolated or anything like that.
Exactly. Like, everybody needs to have their community. We talk about it all the time, that's so mm-hmm. important for your mental health as well, of feeling that you've got that support
right.
of community. Kate, would you say, if you had to weigh up sort of what the percentages were in your colleagues of male v female, do you tend to work in a mainly male environment, or are there plenty of other females like you?
That's an interesting question. So in the United States, I work in a male-dominated industry. I work in transportation. And in the United States, our offices are 80% men easily. But in Asia, which was the first two assignments I had and I moved to, so the first three to four years of my expat life, it was 80% women, which was a fascinating shift. What I will say, though, is we have very, very few expats. We're a company of over 400,000 people, but we only have about 120 expats.
Right.
So all of those numbers are local people.
One of the things I loved that you'd made a point about was when you're waiting for that service person to come, and whether it's getting your television connected or your electricity
yep.
or whatever, it really, your comment really reminded me of, there's a great book written by a woman called Annabel Crabb called The Wife Drought, and she was saying how so many of us need the traditional wife, do you know, that would have been around
uh-huh.
to sort of do those things, right? So did you find that hard? Did you find that people just expected that you'd have someone at home to look after those things for you, that you wouldn't need to take the time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, most of our expatriates are men or Western European, and most of them have stay-at-home wives already. It's sort of a thing long ago in my company. When you tried to hire or get hired into the company, they also interviewed your wife to make sure that she was ready. Like, it's an old school company in a lot of ways. Yeah. So when I'm telling you, like, they don't know what to do with me when I show up, like, this is the history and context of part of it. So, like, I arrived and my boss and the head of HR were like, oh, welcome to Singapore. Let's take you out to dinner. We'll bring our wives and you can, oh, well, yeah, we'll take you out to dinner. Like, they were just ready to say, you and your partner. And then we're like, no, it shouldn't have one. It's going to be weird. It's not a couple's night anymore. it was constantly things like that. Or, so you'll get all set. You know, well, they did give me relocation services who took me around to see new apartments and get the lay of the land in both Singapore and Bangkok. And I remember halfway through the first day, they were like, I'm not really sure how we should schedule the day, because usually we spend half the day going to see school, but you don't have kids. Like, true. And they're like, yeah, okay, no, we can figure this out. But there's like, okay, let me find clubs for you to, there's the women's club and all this stuff, which I went in to look up, and they're oriented around people who don't have a normal corporate day job.
Yes.
So it was like, oh, these clubs look phenomenal, but they meet at 10 in the morning. I'm at the office. Like,
yes.
And so, like, I pointed it out once or twice to our HR person, and they just looked dumbfounded. It really just hadn't ever occurred to them, and they didn't know what to do. And so just for the sake of keeping the peace and all, I pretty much just let it go and figured it out on my own. But it did mean that I had that much more burden to sort everything else out on my own and my own community. And I had to, you know, kind of navigate some of these policies. And I know I missed out on financial incentives because they were all written for wives, not single women expats.
And how did you meet people? Like, did you find that there was a bit of a pushback? Like, I imagine, was there a culture of, you know, drinks after work? And then if there's drinks after work, was there any awkwardness that you were with all the guys, or did you befriend the guys' wives? Like, how did that look? What was that?
Yeah, so I do have more male friends after working as an expat. I'm not normally a person like that. I actually usually have more female friends than male friends. So it was a bit of a shift. I'm used to more female company and topics that can be discussed freely among women, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So that was a shift. These men would introduce me to their wives, and I would often get met with some suspicion, which was a bit, I mean, it's just frustrating. It was certainly unsettling because I didn't think I'd done anything to warrant suspicion, but I was spending an incredible amount of time with these women's husbands. I spent all day, a lot of the time with them, and then oftentimes I went out at night and they wanted to blow off steam and not go home and right away and help with the kids and that sort of thing, which, you know, that's between them and their wives. But then I was the one that was still there. And so they were not always very friendly.
Yeah.
So that was tough. That was really tough because I didn't think I'd done anything to warrant it. And usually I'm friends with women, so I was really hoping for those friendships. And a lot of the time it just didn't happen.
It's so bizarre because it all sounds like such a 1950s issue, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like the modern workplace. I mean, this isn't a conversation that we have in the modern workplace. It's like stepping back in time.
Right. Very much so. Very much so. Yeah, and that was, I mean, that was part of the shock for me to move to the Asia workforce too, because the discrimination I faced, and I was a head of department. I mean, I'm not a low-level person, but because I wore a skirt, I always took the notes. I was expecting a coffee. I was somehow magically the only person who could work the conference phone. I mean, it was a lot.
Now, tell me, do you still find that now? I mean, you've moved to Europe now. You're not in Asia. Do you find it's dramatically different now?
It's easier in Europe. We do have more female expats in Europe. That helps. And we have a lot of what we call third country nationals. So they're European citizens who are just being moved around the EU. And so that, I think, makes people a little more familiar with it. Plus the cultures are a little more egalitarian. But the expectations around what you'll do as an expat are still the same. They still expect that I will somehow magically be in the office as soon as I get off the airplane constantly. And yet, magically, my apartment will be set up. The utilities will be turned on. And they don't give me a support. The support they give is to find an apartment, and that's the end of it. All of the others, they just somehow think I'll magically be in both places.
So tell me, Kate, what do you think we need to do to make change?
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to do is more women need to take these offerings and say something. I didn't on my first rotation because it was too new. I didn't want to make waves, but it's partly on me and other women like me to take these jobs and say something. But I also wish for more women who are trailing spouses, especially the ones who may have lost their jobs as part of the move, to reach out to women like me and be like, oh yeah, we get it. We work, we have that mentality. Let us make time for you in the evening so that we can have friends. Just get a little more open to us.
Now, Kate, do you think that being an expat has affected your relationships?
Yes. So I really needed to be an expat to kind of find myself. It just happens to be the thing that defines me is cross-cultural communication and working in cross-cultural environments, which has made me a lot more confident and sure of who I am.
Kate, any advice to any singles out there that are about to embark on expat life?
Definitely do it. Reach out to groups like yours and other ones that they might know of or might be interested in or might be looking for, because you need that community and support, because you won't have it built in. with a partner traveling with you. So definitely reach out, but we're out there and we're more than happy to help.
Loved Kate, loved her. I also like the contrast of Kate having worked for the same company for the past 10 years compared to Lindsay, who's a kind of a different type of single expat. So I think we really nailed that, Kirsty. We should pat ourselves on the back there for getting two different kinds of single. Because I thought it gave a different perspective of a similar situation. And I love that you ended with advice for other singles, whereas I said, what's advice for us about you? Whereas you said, what advice would Kate give? And that she was so positive about it. I think she's great. As soon as I'm so glad you interviewed her, because as soon as she responded to the Facebook post, I was like, I really want to, I want to know more about Kate. So I was so glad that she was the one that you interviewed.
Yeah. And Kate, I had to sort of cut out an entire section about dating and sort of the need for female friendships. I think we sort of went down this other track, which was a fantastic conversation. But, you know, Nikki, I think we've got, both of us have got 10 minute interviews there, and, you know, this podcast could have gone for 4 hours if we would have let it go. But Kate really enthused me because she was saying for her, and I want, this is what I would love for non-singles to take away to from today's conversation, is what I really got from Kate was that female friendships are really important to her. You know, she made the point that she's always been a very female friendship person. She's not really someone that hangs out with the blokes. She's more someone that has her really good female friends. She really enjoys female company. You know, she loves those strong female friendships. And she said, you know, expat life has almost kind of forced her to end up having more male friends because it was so hard to find female friends. And, you know, she talked about guys that maybe stay longer at work when they possibly should be thinking about getting home and putting bathing babies and helping with family stuff. But, you know, that's their family issue. That's not her family issue that she's still at the office with those people. That's not hers. That's them and their issue. But she really made me realize we are an expat community. And I said to Kate, you know, I think maybe I've been a little guilty sometimes where I've gone to a work function because my work is all online. I don't have work functions. You know, I operate in a Slack channel. I talk on Skype. All of my work colleagues are all over the world. So my work life never really, my husband never has any dealings with the people I work with, you know, unless he happens to walk into a room where I'm on the headphones talking to someone from work, but he's not involved. Whereas with him, I go to functions, I meet people, you know, there's golf days, there's, you know, dinners, there's whatever. And quite often, you know, you'll see a single and you'll think, oh, I haven't met them. I didn't know they even existed, I don't think. Do you know? And I think, you know, maybe if that's my initial feeling, is that coming across as suspicion or, you know, coldness or abrasiveness or whatever? It's definitely not meant to, but it did make me think. And the big, big one is for expat women who may have traveled for someone else's job, that if you are isolated and home with kids or whatever, because this is a short period of time where you have moved away from your job, this is your perfect opportunity to network with people who are at work and could get you a job. Do you know, Kate said she has met women who are taking a short break through, you know, having children or that they've traveled for their partner's job. And they've told her, you know, what their qualifications are and what they do. And she's thought, oh my God, I would hire you in an instant if you were available. So in a world now where we've got to be constantly reaching out, networking, keeping those options open for when you do go back to work, you need to make friends with these women because they're going to help you out. So I just hope that today maybe sort of open some minds to how we can network together, you know, go the sisterhood, all look after each other better.
I think that's absolutely right. So there are benefits. There are benefits and both ways. And you shouldn't be suspicious or it's also a matter of just circles, right? So if you caught up in your little kids, and we talked about this before, you're taking them to play dates. So you're hanging out with the parents of the kids that you're friends with, because that's how it is. That's where you are. That's where your time's being spent. But if you want to look up and say, oh, I need other adult company where I don't have to talk about my kids all the time. Perfect.
Yes.
Grab a single, make a friend, cook them dinner. Yes. Yes. Come and have them have wine with you when your kids are in bed. You know, put yes. your kids to bed and invite yes. someone over.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. That kind of thing. I think it's just about it's changing your mindset. And I've said this a lot. So when I used to live in Sydney and I would meet people that were new to Sydney, I'd say, oh, hi, you know, and I wouldn't really honestly ask much more about them, where they're from, where they've lived, it's not that I didn't have an interest. It's just that I didn't think about it. And so, well, maybe I didn't have an interest. I don't know. Whereas now I cannot learn enough about other people and where they're from and where they've been. And if I ever was living somewhere in my home country and met someone who was an expat or living there temporarily or was a migrant, I would be much more welcoming to them than I have been in the past. So it's the same kind of sort of thing. Maybe this is helping people understand singles a little bit more.
And yeah.
Not that they're a foreign species. They're just people the same as everybody else.
I loved some of the responses that we got on the Two Fat Expats Facebook group. Leonie, yeah. who I've met Leonie, she used to live in Qatar, but she said being a single expat means it's your choice to be in the location, so that when you meet expat partners, sometimes you don't really identify with some of their frustrations about being moved to a place they don't like. She said you don't go to the coffee mornings because you're working. There are no instant friends at the school gate. And she said, but you have total freedom to choose your own lifestyle and your holidays and your next move, which is true. Leonie used the much despised term trailing spouse, which we do not use on our page. And then sort
it's
of
banned, you know, banned said, in the group.
It's banned. And she said, but, you know, I use it in a politically correct way. And I was trying to explain to Leonie, and I'm saying this out loud because I know her, but I was trying to explain that, you know, it just, we're all expats. It doesn't matter if you have come for someone else's career or you've come for your own career. We're all expats. And I think that these are the things that divide us. When you start saying, oh, I'm not like her because I'm not a trailing spouse. You know, that's you are instantly sort of dividing the two. And yeah, I mean, the only one thing I can say that must be fantastic about being an expat single is nobody's going to call you a trailing spouse and nobody's going to call you an expat wife, do you know, because you'll be an expat woman. And I think that that's all we all want to be, is we don't want to be seen as, oh yeah, you know, she's just here because someone dragged her along.
Yeah. The Facebook group just had, the post had such great responses. So Gina gave us a list of pros and cons. She said pros: complete freedom to choose timing, location and living space. Married friends adopt you easily once you land. You are no threat. So that's good. That's positive. Travel can be on a whim and budgetless because you choose your own budget. You don't have to negotiate it with anybody else. I can use my decent expat salary to buy whatever I wish and just spoil those I love, which is so lovely. And the cons are, as we've heard, you only have one pair of hands for everything, absolutely every last thing. You can't be home for delivery and in the office. You can't hang a picture and check it straight. You have to do the pink jobs, and she put these in inverted commas, and the blue jobs. And often you aren't taken seriously by service providers when it comes to blue jobs, so car servicing and plumbers.
Oh, yeah.
And I do have to say, as someone who does lots of jobs, people do say, oh, is your husband here? You know, is there anyone else I can speak to? Mm.
Oh, yeah, completely.
And she said living in the Middle East is restrictive for dating. Making male friends can be challenging. I'm either a threat to the partner or a challenge to the man, and neither is fun, which is sort of the opposite side of marriage friends.
Yeah, you hadn't thought of that, had it? Is that even if the wife does adopt you and says, oh, thank God, you know, someone to have a glass of wine with at the end of the day, is that woman's partner going to see you as, is my wife suddenly going to start going out and partying with the single person till 2 o'clock in the morning, or will she realize that she's better off without me? Single life is much more fun. I don't know.
Will she tell her about the times I hang out at work when I should be coming home?
Louise Cotton said something similar. She said, expat couples give me a wide berth, which is so frustrating when I'm A, not looking for a partner and so I'm no threat, and B, there doesn't seem to be any other single expats here where she is. She said, which results in a very lonely life. She said the local culture is very conservative and one based around family, so they're all pretty closed off to her. Oh, that is, someone go and find Louise, please, and invite her over for dinner and, give her a glass of wine and have some fun. I think that's
and take a photo and post it.
Message Louise. Yeah, I want to message Louise, find out where she is and find her a friend.
Sarah also commented on the post. She said she's a single expat with a six-year-old son, and she loved all the comments that were being made, totally agreed on the pros and cons, and highlights that it's hard to determine if it's better or worse because it's just different. So some days she looks at happy couples and feels like she's missing out. And other days she books an amazing trip somewhere cool on her commute to the office without discussing it with anyone. That's cool.
Yes.
I like that.
That
one
is cool.
And then also Sarah wrote, as an expat single and longtime stalker of the podcast and this group, I'm really looking forward to this podcast. Sorry, Sarah, this one's for you. This whole podcast, we're dedicating it. She said she agrees with a lot of other comments, but she has so much freedom, but all the decisions are mine, which is a massive positive, but all the decisions are mine, which is also a massive negative. Every single decision.
Yes.
Sometimes I would like not to make a decision and have someone else make it and just go along for the ride. She didn't realize this until she was traveling with a single expat friend, and they both didn't want to make any decisions about their trip, and they were both happy to roll with what the other decided. And then they realized that they were both tired of making all the decisions. So they just traded decision-making days, which is cool. And she said, I will say, as an expat single in a place that's not renowned for expat living, I feel I gave away the years of my life that I may have found a partner and started a family. However, friends have returned home for the purpose of wanting more chances that still have not succeeded. So there's nothing is guaranteed. I just decided I want to live the best life I could, whatever relationship status I found myself. I've met amazing people who've become family to me. The other big downside is that each time you move, you lose your entire support network. So even when you're sick, it's all on you. So when you're sick and you have to crawl to the bathroom, there's no one saying, you can do it, or there to get you a clean towel, or, put you in the shower or anything like that. So, as with everyone, when you're away from your family at home, it's hard, single or in a relationship. But what most of my family don't realize is that they're it for me, for family. So while they all have their own families, in-laws and our family, I only have them. So when they're not interested and they don't call, I don't really have any other family, and she finds that difficult, which I totally understand.
Yeah. Everybody needs that expat girlfriend too, don't they? Like whether you've got a partner or you haven't got a partner, and I think that maybe that's the thing, Nikki, I walked away from too, is realizing, sometimes people look coupled up and supremely happy and that, they've just got each other. And we need to remember that some people who are married are the loneliest people around, and that we all need to have good friends. Like, everybody needs the emergency contact. Okay, Nikki, three favorite things. So first off, one I wanted to mention, when we did our summer series, I said how I'd watched the first half of the first episode of The Hunting and thought to myself, this is too good to watch without watching it with all of my kids. And so I was saving it for when the kids were here. And so last week I said to everyone, okay, I want to watch The Hunting. And everyone went, oh, no, that looks really boring. I don't want to watch that. That looks terrible, blah, blah, blah. And I got fobbed off for a week. And finally, was it yesterday? Because we have a half day at school, and Greg took some time because, you know, he's trying to sort of see as much of the kids as he can and maintain his employed state. Anyway, he came home and I said, right, I really want to watch this. Had many complaints, watch, and the kids were addicted. By the end of the first episode, they were like, quick, play the next one and play the next one and play the next one. And you could, because they're shorter than an hour. There's four.
So what's the outcome?
Absolutely brilliant. So The Hunting is all about two teenagers who are at school together, a boy and a girl. They're on Skype and their conversation gets very touchy-feely, you could say, over Skype, and basically he screenshots her masturbating, which, you know, it's about a minute of, you know, this chat, and then she quickly, you know, flattens down the laptop and runs away going, oh, my God, I can't believe I just did that. She's got no idea he has screenshotted it and videoed it, and he shares it to a website, which is a website where all the local boys are uploading videos or photos of girls where the girls have sent them video. This is a common theme, I gather, Nikki, around the world, that boys have these websites of, you know, sluts near you or our local sluts or whatever. And so the whole idea of the show is in my mind, it's really split up into three groups. You see the perspective of the girls, you see the perspective of the boys, and then you see the perspective of the adults, whether that's the teachers and the parents. And I think the reason it is so intoxicating to watch is you realize there's so much more to it than just saying, you know, I think too often the knee-jerk reaction is, why would you take a selfie, or why would you put yourself in a compromising position where someone could share something of you? And then you realize the problem is so much deeper than that, that it's so much with the boys. It's a position of power to have one of these photos, power that the boys have the photo that they feel like, because there's a moment in it, and I'm not giving anything away, where one boy is cross with a girl, and that's why it gets posted and shared to everyone. And then you can see he's going to go out and see it's all about who else has got pictures of this girl, who else can share them. And it's really that much more than a sexual thing. It is much more a position of power. And for the girls, the biggest eye-opener for me was that they're not so much sexually involved with anyone. They've never actually touched anyone, and that they're quite comfortable to do things through screens rather than do things in person. And so there's that confusion, and it's just how badly adults deal with this stuff. It's really, it is brilliant and totally worth watching.
Does it show you how adults should deal with it, or does it just show you all the wrong ways and you think?
Well, we had a great conversation at the end of it. That was one of the things I really liked, because my husband was stuck on the, why would you take a selfie in a compromising position that you just know is going to get shared? And he was asking my daughters, and they were saying, because you trust people that they're not going to share them because it's your boyfriend, or it's, you know, someone you really like. And also you feel most of these selfies, people don't show their face. And so you feel like that you're safe anyway. The whole thing about in one of these, because there's two scenarios in the program, is one of the girls takes a photo and her face is in there. But in most of the pictures, there's no face. You know, the girls are just sharing bodies so that their faces aren't there. And I guess they think that protects them in some way. But it was also the adults' reaction of just deciding the girls were promiscuous, you know, whether that was the mother of the son or the father or whatever. And that so often we put the onus on the girls instead of thinking about the boys. As if the boys didn't realize that maybe if you were ever to receive a photo like that, you should just delete it and get rid of it, because you are a holder of child pornography. There's an interesting situation where it goes to court and people that you think would have been safe because you would have thought they'd done nothing wrong were charged because they were distributing child pornography.
Yeah, which is so true. And I say that to my kids all the time. And especially in Europe, because the laws in Europe are much more strict with regards to personal photos and safety and security and everything. I just say, don't ever take the photo. And if you do take it, delete it. And if someone sends you one, delete it. And never ask anyone else for one. Delete it, delete it, delete it. It's so tough for teens. So I think that shows like that point out the positives, the negatives, and the repercussions are really good. And especially if they create a really good conversation within your family afterwards, I think that's great. So we'll have to look into that here.
What about you? What's one of your favorite things?
Well, I think it's something else that you've also got listed. So maybe we can share this favorite thing this week, which is the Rough Translation podcast from last week that I do subscribe, but also people sent it to us as well. And it was called Mum in Translation. I know we both listened to it, so we can talk about it. But just to, in case you haven't listened to it, it was about a US Army family that moves for work or for the Army. And it was a family where there was a mother who was American, and I assume based on the description, she was European, of a European background.
I think she says, I'm your classic blonde, blue-eyed American Midwest girl or something.
And then her husband was Filipino, so her children had, and they were more Filipino looking. So her children had dark hair, dark eyes, and different color skin to her. And so often that people didn't think that they were necessarily her children. And she told of a very traumatic incident once in a supermarket or a shop where someone wouldn't give her a child back because they didn't believe it was hers. And which would be awful. And how one of her, she has three children, and how one of them felt always a little bit out of place. And then when they moved to Japan for a posting, he felt as if she was actually looking forward to it because she knew that she would be the one that was more out of place rather than her husband and her children. And she thought that that would be good for everybody. And when her son moved there, he really, really embraced it. And it was kind of about the experiences of the family and particularly of the son in this situation.
Yeah. And it was intriguing, wasn't it? Because they obviously already had an existing issue with her son. She said she knew that he was quite sensitive to this fact before they even went away.
Yeah.
And that once they got to Japan, he thought, oh, this is where I belong. These are my people, sort of thing, to the fact that he didn't want to go to the international school. He wanted to go to the local school. He wanted to hang out. And she was so impressive that she just did all these things for him to give him what he wanted, didn't she? I mean, so many of us, I think, would say, well, no, it's just easier to have, you know, this is the schooling we get provided. This is where your siblings are going. You will go to school with everyone else. But no, she didn't. She said, yes, I will ride my bike to wherever, to drop you to wherever so you can be a part of this. And even though we can't speak Japanese, you know, we will put you in this school. And even though I can't do these things, we will put you in this school and whatever. And she did. And he absolutely loved it and thrived and thought it was fantastic. And all the way through this, Nikki, I was thinking, but you're going to have to leave. You're with the army. Like, this is, you are going to have to leave. Do people not think about this? Like, why are we doing this when we know we're going to have to tell this poor child that he's going to leave? But yeah, it was really, really good, but such a unique expat story.
Absolutely. And I think that it was also very, I mean, Rough Translation is an NPR, it's an American podcast. It was designed, you could tell it was pretty much, although a lot of their stories are international, it was, well, they all are, hence the name of the podcast. It was designed for an American audience to listen to, I felt.
Yes.
So it was talking about her son, and there's lots of interviews with him, and he was gorgeous and I loved him. But it was very much about being an American parent in an American culture and how that can change. And I mean, we've talked about it before. When you live in different countries, you parent in different ways because that's what the parents do in those countries. And then you feel more or less comfortable about doing it. So it's really quite a big journey. I don't want to use the word journey, but path, whatever, for the mother.
That word's become, that word journey has really just been trashed so much now that nobody can use it without feeling like a cliche, can they?
And awakening, whatever. But, you know, and I want to say that outside of the podcast, I wouldn't be surprised if there were other things going on in this family.
Yes.
That's the first thing I thought of when they talked about the child and how he did particular things and how he liked particular things and did things a certain way and didn't have friends and didn't want to make friends, was happy being by himself. But that being said, they told the story in a very, very supportive way and a forgiving way. And I thought it really, because you could have really felt that the mum was really not too strict, but just too structured in her approach. I think they used the term helicopter parenting, but basically the outcome was that she has changed, that her experience there with her children has allowed her to change when she's now back in America and in different locations.
Which too, I think would happen anyway, because you have a whole different perspective once you've hung out with other different cultures and whatever. But for her, I mean, when she talked about him going to the Japanese school and that most Japanese kids walk in a line together on their own to school, it's like when you hear people who move to Hong Kong and they say about kids are on the subway, you know, when they're very, very young and without parents, and it's all very different. It's, you know, picking up those different cultures. But yeah, I thought there was a lot more to it when she said her son had asked her to dye her hair black so that she looked more like him, you know. So there was obviously a lot more going on in his mind. He really wanted everybody to be the same, didn't he, and everything to be the same. He didn't like those differences. And I totally get it, because I was thinking, I listened to this when my children were here, and, you know, because my children are apart and together, because they're, you know, some are at boarding school, some are in this house, some are in a different house. So when they're all together, one of the things that really bonds them and that they thrive on is how much they look alike, and they bring it up all the time. And I don't know whether I was just sensitive to this because I was listening to this podcast, but the youngest child is about to get, he's just had braces on his teeth. And so the older three have all had the same orthodontist, and they said to him, oh, you have matching teeth like ours now. And you could tell that they were quite happy with that idea. They want him to have matching teeth to them. They call them Dr. Hisham teeth because it's Dr. Hisham that put their braces on. And the four of them all look different, but they've all got a little piece of each other. It's quite bizarre. You know, two of them have ended up with the same skin, but a different two of them have ended up, you know, when I say I have two very white children and two olive children, and I have, but then one of those olive children and one of those white children have exactly the same eyebrows and eyes. Do you know, like there is distinct things that they all, when I have my four together, people will say they're all different but the same. It's really freaky.
They are. If you look at photos on your Instagram, the other day I was looking and I couldn't tell. I was like, I think that's daughter one, or is it daughter two? Because when they're in separate Instagrams with their friends, I can tell. But when they're together, I was like, I don't know which one's which. Is that one taller or is that one taller? They do. Your children, especially your older three, must be the teeth, do look very similar. And then you look at you and your husband, you think, which one do they look most like? Because when you look at them, they could actually look like you or they could look like G. And so there's this whole thing like that as well. So, yes, the four of them are definitely a team, and the six of you are definitely a family.
Yes. And they love it. And so I was quite interested by that, you know, here's this little boy saying to his mum, you need to look more like us, dye your hair. I was really, but I thought great story and great in that it had that real NPR feel to it. You know, everybody is starting to sound like Ira Glass now, like everybody on NPR. It's just like you don't get hired unless you sound like Ira Glass, but their story is so well told. And it was nice to sort of hear that expat tale.
Yeah.
And interesting. And Japan is fascinating. I think that's what else made it interesting too.
To me also, the going to school and also the school principal saying we do the interview to find out whether the parents have got what it takes to be parents at the school. I just thought that was interesting. That really intrigued me. The Japan school stuff. The other stuff I felt was relatable for various reasons, but the inside the Japanese school was where I was really listening very carefully to how it all was unfolding.
Yeah, no, me too.
It's my next favorite thing from the week, which is, and I'm sure that if you've listened to any podcast that recommends shows or you love watching Netflix, you would have already seen this or know about it. But one of my favorite things was Unbelievable. And I don't know, have you seen Unbelievable, Kirsty? Or
no, we've been saving it, and I want to ask you because. So the bits I've heard are that the first episode is completely different than the following episodes that ensue, and that a lot of people watch the first episode and think, why am I watching this? But it is based on a true story, right?
It is based on a true story, which is why the first and second episodes really need to be there, because it's, and it does deal with sexual assault. I will say that now before I start speaking. So if anyone wants to fast forward a few minutes or whatever, but it is based on a true story of a young girl who was sexually assaulted, raped in her own home. And she was sort of a young, vulnerable girl who'd been in the foster care system and was living in sort of a supportive group home environment. And she reported it to the police. And then in this very much this sort of victim blaming, victim questioning culture, they questioned her again and again. And it's a true story, so there's no spoilers or surprises. But basically, they talked. She ended up recanting her story, so she recanted it because they put so much pressure on her. Last time you told me it was this way, now you're telling me, you know, the pan was on the other side of the stove. I mean, that's not an example, but they just really got down to the minutiae, and she recanted her story, and then she became a total outcast. Like, the repercussions for her life were horrible, in that people had thought that she was assaulted and then she wasn't, and that she'd lied about it, and, you know, she lost all sorts of personal things, very, very difficult. And then that story sort of flashes ahead to 3 years later in another state where there's a detective investigating a sexual assault, and her husband also works in some sort of law enforcement. He says, oh, that sounds a bit similar to something that we've had where we're working. So she then teams up with another detective who is played by Toni Collette, who is amazing. I love Toni Collette in this role. And they sort of set off together as a female duo and set up a bit of a task force to prove that their sexual assaults are related, and then to sort of find the person. And they end up finding the person, which is, I think, about 3 years later. And in the course of finding the person, they find evidence that the sexual assault from the other state years before on this young vulnerable girl did in fact happen. And then you go back and see how that. So it's the first episode is really, it's awful to watch, and it's depressing and it's heartbreaking. And you wouldn't really want to go on. I can understand why people do watch it and think, oh no. But then it sort of, it changes pace, it changes direction. But I think it's really important that they tell that story and show all those repercussions in advance. So,
right.
So that when they come back at the end to finish it up and close it up and come back and revisit the policeman that, you know, that told her she was lying and got her to recant and all that sort of stuff. And I think that it's important that they've given you the full story in the beginning so you can come back at the end and, I mean, you never feel better about it, but you sort of understand then what happens. But it is based on a true story, and it's tough watching in some places, but I think it's amazing. And I love Toni Collette in it.
I think she's a superstar.
Mm. So is it hour-long episodes?
I think it is about an hour, sort of 50 minutes to an hour, and I think it's 8 episodes.
Do you think you've got to be 18 to watch it? Would you let your, I guess, would you let your 16-year-old watch it?
I would let him watch it. I don't think he'd be interested, but I wouldn't let my 13-year-old watch it yet, I don't think. I don't think it's something she'd be interested in, but I think...
All right, well, we'll definitely be doing that because it keeps coming up, right? And what has held me back is that, I would probably watch it with Miss 17, but I have missed a 13. And he keeps saying, yeah, we can watch it. I'll just put my headphones on. It's like, no. But I was just worried about how traumatic that first episode was. But, yeah, it sounds like a goodie.
Okay, my last favourite thing this week, and I'll be very quick, is that my German teacher from 30 years ago I have reconnected with. When I was, I did German for my HSC, so when I left school, and I have really had a thing against her for the past long time because my parents came home from a parent-teacher night and said, your teacher said you could be the best student in the class if you just paid more attention and tried better because you've got an ear for languages or something like that. And I thought, bloody hell. I had two girls in my class that had German parents. Yes. And I was absolutely horrified and appalled. And I've just held it against her for 30 years. And I was the worst.
Hang on. I feel the need to speak for any teacher that's listening to this now. So she told your parents that you had talent and that you were capable, and you have translated that into, so what, there's two other girls in the class that have German parents.
Yeah, well, I'm getting to that. I'm talking about what I heard as a teenager, how I internalized it. And then okay. 30 years later, so I was having this discussion. We were having a discussion with some of my school friends online about teachers. And I said, you know, Mrs. Walwerk and the German. And then I thought, you know what, I'm going to Google her. So I Googled her and I found her on Facebook and I wrote her a big, long DM and I said, Mrs. Warwick, you might not remember me, but I was, I was Nikki Eddy at school and I was a boarder and, you know, you told my parents this and I've held it against you for 30 years and now it's come back to bite me in the bottom because now I live in Germany and my German's pretty crap.
And within, had no idea.
Yeah, exactly. And she wrote back and she said, of course I remember you, almost immediately. Of course I remember you. I would never. And, of course, this is my parents. This is like third hand that I've had this information because the teachers told something to my parents who then told me. So I mean, your parents can put any sort of spin on anything they want, right? So So she said to me, I remember that you could have been a good student. She's even so good now in the language she uses. She said, and I would never compare apples with oranges. The girls with the German parents were, of course, had a different advantage, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I'd love to know about your life. And she Facebook friended me. So I just thought, you know what, if it's a teacher that you're thinking about or if there's someone from your past that you think you should maybe connect with, reach out because you never know. And I am absolutely loving her. I'm loving her Facebook feeds. I'm thinking it's fantastic. So it's one of my favorite things, and it's nothing to do with being an expat, but it's to do, I think, with having some reflection, and maybe it's something I wouldn't have done if I hadn't been living in Germany. In fact, I know it's something I would never have done.
Yes. Oh, I love that. That's a great story.
Yeah, so that was one of my favorite things.
Oh, okay. So I spy with my little expat eye is the map that was shared in the Two Fat Expats Facebook group. And it was from Voucher Cloud and it had the top tourist destinations of every country. Did you see that?
Oh, yes. I totally saw it because the top tourist destination in Germany was in Hamburg.
Yes.
Which I was shocked by. Shocked, I tell you.
So where do you think it should have been?
Well, I would have thought the top tourist destination in Germany would be somewhere in Berlin. It would be the Wall. It would be the Brandenburg Gate. It would just be Berlin itself, perhaps, as in Seoul had the metro system as its top tourist attraction. But it was, in fact, Miniature World, which is this amazing place. It really is an amazing place, but it's always packed. So I tell tourists to go there, but I don't always take them because it's always very full. And it is the whole world in miniature. And you stand there and it goes through day and night. And there's all sorts of things. And, you know, there's at one stage they had built a wall around America. Very tongue-in-cheek. Oh. And so it's constantly changing. They do all these things that they constantly change, and they have seasonal stuff, and, you know, they have ski resorts, and they've got all these little moving parts. They've got airports with planes taking off and ships and all around the world, and it is really quite amazing. But I'm absolutely, absolutely shocked that it's the top tourist destination in Germany, as per whatever that poll was. Anyway. What did you think about it?
Do you know what I thought? I thought it was really interesting that they obviously were, because, I mean, it's all in the name. It's called the top tourist destination, right?
Yes.
So it doesn't mean the most cultural place to go or the best place to go. It just means this is where all the tourists go. And I think most people, when they travel, their travel snobbery comes out in them that they don't want to go where all the tourists go. Do you know, they say, oh, I don't like this restaurant, it's full of tourists, or I don't like this location because it was full of tourists. But then you find yourself looking at this map going, yep, I've been there, and you're very happy that you've been there to the top tourist destination, because you'd be really peeved if you'd gone to that country and hadn't gone to the top tourist destination. But, Qatar's was MIA, which is the Museum of Islamic Art, which is definitely the most stunning building and houses incredible, incredible art. So, definitely they had the right place there. But I thought they showed this huge map of Australia, and then it says Sydney Opera House. All of Australia. But what is interesting is Sydney Opera House is not the place where you pay to go into or be at or whatever. You know, people just go and stand on the steps and
take a photo.
Yeah, take a photo. And it is stunning.
I remember my English friend told me, you know, it's a lot smaller than I thought it was going to be. I said, how big do you expect it to be? It's pretty big. But I don't know. I'm wondering if anyone else has ever thought the Sydney Opera House was smaller than they thought it was going to be. Because I just thought, how could it be bigger? I didn't really understand that. But she said, you know, you get such a feeling that it's this massive, massive thing. I said, but it is. It's big.
It is big. Oh, dear, was she from Texas? No, she was English.
She was English. Now, we do want to say, last week we put out a shout out. We said, please, 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 please review us. We'd love a review on your platform of choice. And we got two fantastic reviews this week. One was from Australia, from Truly Expat, and one was from Seoul, Korea, from KJ Seoul, I think it was. So now we've shouted out and we've got some, we'd like some more.
Nikki, it was amazing. I haven't actually told you this yet, and I'm just going to open my email while we're talking and see if I can find it, because something came through a couple of days ago. It made a massive difference that we had people review us. So, yes, it was a big thing, because immediately we get ping saying, hey, you've been reviewed, come and have a look. Someone came through saying, you know, congratulations, your chart positions, you know, have gone insane or something. And I was like, oh, wow, people must have gone and reviewed us. And it says, Nikki Moffat, that we are, because we come under Places and Travel on iTunes.
Okay.
So on the American iTunes, we're number 72. On the UK iTunes, we're number 27.
Oh, and
And on the Australian iTunes, we're number 19. And, Nikki, something's wrong in Germany because we're only 187.
Well, I don't think all the people I know here in Germany have German iTunes accounts. I think they might have iTunes accounts from other countries. But come on, Germany. Shout out to Germany.
Come on, Germany. But I want to say thank you to people. And I don't know how I got this or why I got this, but it just came through with a couple of reviews. Like it showed the review from the fantastic woman who's living in Singapore, who's from Sydney, saying that she loves the podcast, listens to it no matter where I am. She said, I'm not sure if I can rank it more than once, so I will, but I find myself laughing along with you both, often like we're long-lost friends. And thank you, because I'm sure we will become long-lost friends, because there's another thing going on at the moment, Nikki, is we're thinking about doing a get-together, a big fat expat meetup. We've done one, we've done two before, one in Shanghai, one in Singapore. Anyway, we put a note on the Two Fat Expats Facebook group asking people, where do you think we should meet? And Nikki, I think Singapore is winning hands down. I don't know. Do you want to?
I have it in front of me. So before we started recording, you posted it, and at the moment, Singapore is 90 votes, and it's followed. It's followed by Amsterdam with 35. That's the second closest number of votes.
Oh well, tell us if you're listening to this. Tell us, where do you think we should go? I mean, I understand why Singapore, because it's probably very central in between everyone and easy to go to. And plus, it's a pretty cool place to get together. If you are a Two Fat Expats listener in Singapore and you know of a venue that you think would be good for us to do the live podcast and to get together, I mean, I'm thinking, Nikki, it'd have to involve lunch and a glass of wine, wouldn't it? Or something similar, or dinner and a glass of
something
wine,
like
wouldn't
that. It?
Something like that. And we would sit and do the podcast together and just have some fun. I mean, I have always said, Nikki, that I would love to get all my expat friends in the same place at the same time. Do you know, like, yeah, I've lived in 6 or 7 different countries, and, you know, you meet people all along the way and you think, oh, how good would it be? And it, you just know that it will never happen because it's just so hard to manage. But this is what I'm thinking, is that you have the big fat expat meetup and you say to the people that you were friends with in Jakarta, or friends with in Hong Kong, or friends with in Houston, or friends with whatever, hey, let's all get together and we'll go to this big fat expat meetup and we'll listen to the podcast and we'll just drink a few glasses of wine and have fun. So, yes, but please, 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 can you leave a review? Because it does make a massive difference, and I'd love to see where we end up next week.
Yes, please leave reviews. Please, please love us. Kirsty, I'm going to tell you now, this editing, yeah, I'm going to edit it, but it's not going to be under 60 minutes.
Wait till I'm finished with it.
Speak to you next week.
Speak to you next week. Bye. Bye-bye.